in the limelight. The Srebrenica massacre remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War. More than a quarter of a century later, as new details emerge in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Middle East Eye. The piece is titled, Released Documents Reveal UK Planned Srebrenica Pullout Despite Being Aware of Imminent Carnage. Classified documents show the British government devised plans to withdraw troops from a besieged Muslim enclave at the height of the Serbian onslaught in Bosnia-Herzegovina in July of 1995. Despite being aware of mass killing of thousands by local Serb forces in nearby Srebrenica, nearly 8,300 Muslim men and boys were later found to have been murdered at Srebrenica after a Dutch contingent of the United Nations so-called peacekeeping force deployed in Bosnia withdrew from the town. The Srebrenica massacre, for which Bosnia's Serb leaders were later convicted of genocide, remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War. More than a quarter of a century later, as the UK-based Middle East Eye News outlet reveals new details in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The report, which used declassified British government documents about Bosnian crisis, also points to a new widely acclaimed Bosnian movie, Quo Vadis, Aida, that sheds new light on the tragic carnage in Srebrenica and what it described as the catastrophic failure of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the region as Yugoslavia collapsed into war and violence. Quo Vadis, Aida, directed by Jasmila Zabanić, a survivor of the near four-year siege of the major Bosnian city of Sarajevo by local Serb forces, the movie has been nominated as the best international feature film at the 2021 Oscars and as the best foreign language film at the British BAFTA Awards. According to the released documents, another Bosnian Muslim enclave of Gorazde, where British soldiers made up the main contingent of United Nations peacekeepers, came very close to facing the same fate as Srebrenica. The documents paint a vivid behind-the-scenes picture of Western leaders striving to choose the least worst option presented to them by their advisors, without much regard for the fate of Bosnia's Muslim population facing massacres and other atrocities that were overtly being carried out by Serbian forces. They further revealed that the then British Prime Minister John Major was reluctant to reinforce Gorazde in order to protect its population of more than 30,000, despite, as his private secretary put it, the distressing scenes now daily on our television screens. The documents further show that the British Defence Ministry drafted emergency plans for the evacuation of British troops from the area around Gorazde in July of 1995, at the exact moment that genocidal slaughter was underway at Srebrenica and a third enclave in Zepa had come under attack. Gorazde had come under Bosnian Serb attack in 1994 and again in May of 1995. Gorazde, located on a strategically vital crossroads and surrounded by towering cliffs, was highly vulnerable to another Serbian attack and potential carnage following the fall of Srebrenica and Zepa. The report noted that three eastern towns had been declared safe havens for Muslim Bosniaks by the United Nations Security Council in 1993, after the surrounding territory had been captured by Belgrade-backed Bosnian Serb forces opposed to Bosnia and Herzegovina's declaration of independence in 1992. The report also pointed out that the UN Security Council resolutions had also established that United Nations peacekeepers were only authorized to deter attacks on the three enclaves, but not to protect or defend them. Force could be used only in self-defense. On 16th of July 1995, with a final onslaught against Gorazde, thought to be imminent, British plans, codenamed Operation Screwdriver, to evacuate 350 British soldiers from the town of Gorazde was finalised at the Ministry of Defence in London. According to the report, the disclosure of the British evacuation plans came as little surprise to men who served in the Army of Bosnia-Herzegovina during the war. It then cited Farid Buljubasic, who had served as a lieutenant colonel in the Yugoslav National Army before commanding Bosnian forces in Gorazde from mid-1992 to the end of 1994, as recalling that the so-called United Nations Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, were being led largely by officers who did not understand the nature of the war. Farid Buljubasic recounted that NATO aircraft in 1994 bombed Serb tanks that had already been destroyed. He said, "I would say that the role of the international community in general in Bosnia and Herzegovina was very dishonorable." He further emphasized, "My general impression is that they never understood the character of war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, that they were never neutral, that they faked execution of their tasks, and there is so much evidence that they were extremely inclined towards the Serbs." He added, "They ignored and disregarded the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, as well as the army of Bosnia and Herzegovina. There was politics in all of that." The released documents also make clear that the British Prime Minister at the time, John Major, was determined that the United Kingdom should not be sucked into war with Bosnian Serb forces, and that his senior military commander, Field Marshal Peter Inge, fully supported that decision. Farid Buljubasic further pointed out that a group of 20 British Special Air Service, or SAS, soldiers had been hurriedly evacuated from Gorazde whilst the enclave came under attack in April of 1994. He noted they had been posted to the town as the eyes and ears of UNPROFOR commander Michael Rose, who was himself a British general. Buljubasic added, "When they came, they were pumped up, dressed, they had vests, all sorts of things, camouflage paint. The very moment it got troubling, they vanished." He said, "As the attacks went on, and as the Chetniks or Bosnian Serb forces were getting close to Gorazde, one night those SAS, a helicopter came to pick them up. They took their stuff and ran away without letting anyone know, without anything. They just disappeared. They just disappeared and vanished in one night." The former Bosnian commander observed that the behavior of the forces of UNPROFOR, the United Nations peacekeeping forces, would have been identical to the Dutch at Srebrenica, if not even more shameful. Meanwhile, US President at the time, Bill Clinton, was expressing his frustration at the Bosnian government whilst they were struggling to defend themselves amid a United Nations-imposed arms embargo, whereas the Bosnian Serb forces had inherited large amounts of weaponry from the army of the former Yugoslavia. During a telephone conversation with John Major, Bill Clinton was recorded to have said, "We could hardly blame the Dutch for leaving Srebrenica when the Bosnians themselves had already given up the fight." He further claimed, "The Bosnians made a habit of trying to make other people look bad in the press." The report points out that some sections of the British record of these Clinton major telephone conversations remain redacted, more than a quarter century later, on national security grounds. Following the 2019 declassification of the bulk of the UK government papers on the period. Following the fall of Srebrenica and the attack on Zepa underway, British Prime Minister at the time John Major concluded that Bosnian Serbs would next turn to Gorazde, as the British ambassador in Belgrade reported that the Bosnian Serb army was under high after capturing Srebrenica with so little United Nations opposition and was dangerously unpredictable. However, John Major told both French President Jacques Chirac and US President Bill Clinton that he believed only diplomatic pressure should be applied in an attempt to save Gorazde. According to the report, the Americans regarded Gorazde as a problem for the British and French to deal with and regarded the defense of Sarajevo as a more serious strategic objective. The top British commander in Bosnia, Field Marshal Peter Inge, recommended that if the UK government decided its troops should remain in Gorazde, we should do so as robustly as possible under a pure peacekeeping and humanitarian mandate option and then seek a negotiated withdrawal with dignity, as the Dutch have done, but being prepared to use air power.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Pattingill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace. That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu. Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
Not for me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the US, And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film, because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and, you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer you see Reagan saying, "Make America Great Again," which obviously we have more modern connotations to today. But it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance-driven thing to a more sort of style and, you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
But perhaps the onus of the documentary and perspective is on the rests in the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without generation.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much, you know, it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world, but reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even more pernicious, perhaps. But I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, and it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed. And we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image of a president.
So Neil, if I could bring you in here, that was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said, and I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made, but the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically, it was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round the log fire, all American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalized with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts, and this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show. And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and we see the mask slip a bit when we see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. Mm. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly bright. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to have had a reputation of being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense the documentary is capturing this, isn't it? But he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image, and the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. Mm-hmm. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theatre that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage, you know, and you saw him in the clip before. He ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor. Mm-hmm. And that's fascinating to me because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president. But actually, a sort of very average to mediocre actor mm-hmm. can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting. And we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War. By making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency, you'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office. So Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. And as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
So Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like, and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states, where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements, and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks. The defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well, with the Nicaraguan Revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents two things. He represents a kind of counterattack by the corporations and the rich inside America against workers, against the poor, and against the social movements. And internationally, an attempt to reassert US imperial control over what is effectively an informal empire. They want to shore up US power at a time when the US economy is weakening, and that weakening of economic clout, which had been crucial to US power in the 50s and the 60s, to some degree you can compensate for that by substituting a more aggressive military stance. And I think that's what's happening under Reagan.
And in this documentary, you learn that he was called a trigger-happy president. Although he said he strived for peace, we saw sort of contradictions there.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right, because there's this massive, massive increase in arms expenditure, which brings it right up to the level that it was at the beginning of the Cold War in the early 1950s. And it creates a huge economic problem for the United States, a massive, massive budget deficit. I mean, all this stuff, you know, all this neoliberal stuff they're saying about how we need to control our budgets and we don't want big government, it's all nonsense. If you look at the military expenditure and the way it's being funded by borrowing, it has a crippling effect on the US economy in the long run. But what it does do is it breaks the back, this is the crucial thing, I think, of the Soviet Union. Because the Soviet Union, a much smaller economy and a failing economy, simply can't match these levels of arms expenditure. So you've got a second Cold War, which in a sense, Reagan wins by just upping the stakes to a level which the Soviets can't match.
That's really interesting. I want to pick up that point in the next part of the discussion, actually. And Lee, if I could ask you, did you see any similarities between Reagan and Trump? because many critics are drawing many similarities between them and parallels.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Trump would love to be, you know, as idolized as Reagan. And, you know, the whole Make America Great Again, which you hear Reagan say very early on in this documentary, you know, there's no, that's not a coincidence. He's trying to echo the sort of style. The difference is, and again, regardless if you agree with the policies, Reagan has a charm and a sort of, you know, acceptability to a large number of people. Trump obviously has a base. I mean, he won the election, even if he lost the popular vote. But it's kind of, you know, right-wing Republicanism with the mask off. It's the sort of the aggression and the kind of tit-for-tat stuff and the sort of intolerance is, which was, you know, largely covered by Reagan's, you know, kind of charm and sort of, you know, persona. That's all gone. And what's interesting now is it's like you don't even need that cover, it seems, at the moment to kind of succeed. And that's quite a sort of fairly terrifying development, I would say.
Indeed, and critics say that actually Reagan set the precedent for today's facts don't matter politics. And critics also say that Trump sort of coined this fake news sort of propaganda and techniques from the Reagan era. And we heard in the documentary, actually, that Reagan was aware of the frenzy he would cause with the media just to be able to dodge questions, so to speak. So do you think that there are similarities between the two?
Yeah, but we must be careful. I mean, fake news is a current term, but politicians have always lied, especially when they're defending a vested interest. They've always lied to the people. So we need to be quite careful. And that's, you know, that's the old word, really, for fake news, in a sense. But I think it is true. There's been a ramping up of that. And Reagan starts it, and it's now at an absolutely epidemic level, I think, with Trump and actually with the Tory government in Britain as well. We've actually got to a point where lying has become, fake news if you like, lying seems to have become pretty much systematic and institutionalized. So politicians are completely routinely saying the opposite to the public of what is actually happening behind the scenes. And it's there with Reagan, because everything Reagan is saying about, you know, this is a struggle between right and wrong, this is a crusade for freedom, Russia is the evil empire, all of this kind of stuff, this Cold War rhetoric that's being pumped out, is hiding, I mean, terrible atrocities and injustices which are being perpetrated by American imperialism.
So we see a lot of Gorbachev featuring in this documentary, and I think he's portrayed in a more charismatic light, and he seems to come across as a more bold leader than Reagan from the media clips that we've seen in this film. Lee, can I ask you, what did you make of their rivalry and how Gorbachev was portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the film is The Reagan Show, and it obviously concentrates on Reagan, but Gorbachev becomes a major player within the film because it kind of builds, you know, the Cold War as the overarching narrative for it. He comes across as incredibly charismatic and very intelligent, and I think what you see is there's a section where they show that actually the Russians or the Soviet Union hire an American PR firm to help with their own promotion and, you know, marketing effectively. So it's very clear that, I think the other thing we have to be really careful is, this is not just an American or a Western thing, this performance thing. Every country indulges in this. Every nation, you know, distorts the views that they need to sort of, you know, win the public opinion and stuff. It's not just the States, it's not just the West. And you see how the Soviet Union becomes very adept very quickly, and it's also got a very media-savvy figurehead who can basically go toe-to-toe with Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I think as much as Reagan obviously, you know, had a big part to play in the Cold War, I think you underestimate Gorbachev's role also doing that, whether it's only because, you know, the Soviet Union couldn't afford an arms race, but I think, you know, you could also look at it in a positive way and say, yes, there's also an impetus to try and break this kind of escalation that's going on.
That is a good point, actually. It does make you think, this documentary, about how intertwined the media and politics are. And Neil, I just wanted to quickly touch on how Star Wars was introduced in this documentary, and was seen as actually not existing, and it was a PR stunt to bring the Russians to the negotiating table. How accurate is this?
I think the Star Wars initiative was very, very real. I mean, I think this is why it's true to call it the Second Cold War, because if the US had developed a technology to shoot missiles down from space, the effect would have been that the mutually assured destruction, which had basically acted as a mutual deterrent would suddenly have gone. The Russians were genuinely very, very frightened by this development and couldn't match it. They didn't have the technology and they didn't have the economic resources. And I think that that is a stick with which to beat Gorbachev. You see, I think Gorbachev was actually a more serious political player than Reagan. I think he really was driving it. I mean, what you see actually on the screen with Gorbachev is real. He's the young reformer who really is trying to transform the Soviet Union. And behind the scenes, what's actually happening is Reagan and his advisors are not giving much ground at all, particularly on Star Wars. And it's actually the Russians who make all of the concessions because they're so desperate.
Yes, we do see it, especially from this documentary, that the Americans are on the back foot. And so the final 20 seconds to you, Lee, as we're running out of time, would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I mean, it's a fascinating look at, you know, an era that really where video and, you know, the performance aspect came to power. You could argue that, you know, this is not, it didn't start with Reagan. You think of Kennedy and Nixon and the TV debates that people thought TV Kennedy won and radio thought Nixon won. But, it, you know, it's, it shows that it got ramped up in, at this moment and it had a Hollywood actor. So it's kind of a perfect, you know, Hollywood movie. You know, the medium becomes the message, basically.
Oh, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
In GDP terms, China is currently the second largest economy, although it is expected to displace the United States as the largest economy this decade. China was the only economy to grow in 2020. Further, the International Monetary Fund assesses that China's economy will surpass the United States in growth in 2021. And as recent events have shown, the United States itself is not immune from internal collapse. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Bernardon J. Richard, author. This article is published under the heading, Is America Weaker Than China? Stay tuned for more. The United States is no longer qualified to speak to us from a position of strength, said the senior diplomat from the People's Republic of China to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a particularly frosty meeting in Alaska. Much to the Joe Biden administration's credit, it appears to be taking the potential threat that China poses the United States more seriously than it did during the contentious 2020 presidential campaign. Yet one must ask an uncomfortable question. What if China's representatives are correct? As David P. Goldman reports, American influence is fragile in several key Eurasian nodal points, and China has the capacity to hurt the United States in retaliation for American efforts to build an alliance to contain it. In other words, as America spastically pivots to Asia, China sinks toward its west. And the reason that China is even attractive to the powers along its western periphery is China's increasing power. Part of the problem is perception. The way that American policymakers measure national power is insufficient for the 21st century. Chinese scholars have developed a much better method to analyze the competitive power of a nation-state. Known as the Comprehensive National Power CNP assessment, China's methodology for measuring the nation's power relative to those of its competitors helps to explain how China has evolved into a serious challenger to the United States and its allies over the last 30 years. American analysts should study the CNP methodology and apply that when assessing U.S. power relative to that of its competitors. During the Cold War, the Soviets used a similar methodology, which they referred to as the correlation of forces. This kind of analysis would help policymakers devise better strategies for responding to the all-out society challenges emanating from China and elsewhere. One notable version of the CNP comes from Chinese scholar Huang Shougang. Huang's variant comprises a material or hard power index, such as economic wealth, natural resources, science and technology, military might, spirit or soft power index, such as political power, foreign affairs, culture, education, coordinated power index, such as line of command, leadership in policy decision making, and finally, environmental index, such as international environment. Beyond that, Huang's version of the CNP assessment has an appraisal index system, which includes national strategy goals, political stability, and decision-making capabilities. Huang long argued that the United States would remain the world's preeminent power from 2000 until 2020. He predicted that by 2020, China would be second. This certainly appears to be an analysis conducted over many years by Huang and his fellow scholars of national power at China's Academy of Military Science, AMS. The CNP model notwithstanding, since 2014, China became the largest economy in terms of purchasing power parity, that is PPP. In GDP terms, China is currently the second largest economy, although it is expected to displace the United States as the largest economy this decade. China was the only economy to grow in 2020. Further, the International Monetary Fund assesses that China's economy will surpass the United States in growth in 2021. American tech entrepreneurs like Elon Musk believe that China will become the world's largest economy this decade. This is a far cry from a decade ago, when many Western analysts were warning of China's coming collapse. There are certainly downsides to China's rapid development that could impinge on long-term growth, although these negative effects have yet to be fully experienced, as evidenced by China's continued growth. And as recent events have shown, the United States itself is not immune from internal collapse. It all comes down to relative national strength. Yes, The United States has an overwhelmingly strong military on paper, with less than 1% of American population serving in the all-volunteer force at any given time, and with the capabilities of rival powers increasing every year, the question must be asked, how reliable will America's military supremacy be over time? What's more, how potent can America's comprehensive national power remain? The U.S. military itself is highly dependent on technology to amplify its relatively small size. It requires constant additional funding to upgrade its technological accoutrements, and relatively small expediency force is always being stretched. Despite the size of its budget, the military cannot keep up with current force requirements, let alone possibly take on a rising great state competitor like China, or, heaven forbid, a coalition of Eurasian powers. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates was correct when he cautioned that any future American leader who wants to fight a land war in Eurasia ought to have his head examined. But as China's comprehensive national power grows and ultimately outstrips America's, and if the United States wants to retain its dominant position in the world system, that is precisely what may happen. China's population is becoming more educated in strategically critical fields like science, technology, engineering, and math than are Americans. The Chinese are far more patriotic than their American competitors are. The Chinese infrastructure is more advanced than that of the United States of America. In the hit series Game of Thrones, the treacherous character Littlefinger admonishes the Cersei Lannister that knowledge is power. Yet Littlefinger's actual power, in spite of his vast knowledge, is insignificant. Cersei counters his quip with an actual display of military force, during which he explains that power is power. In the 21st century, however, it is clear that knowledge is the basis of capabilities, and greater capabilities allow for greater power over one's rivals. This is the foundation of the CNP assessment and why China's rise over the next decade should worry Americans today.
Mali has been plagued by instability and conflict. It was in 2012 when Tuareg separatists allied with Al-Qaeda and Daesh-linked groups launched a rebellion and took control of the north. But soon after, the terrorist groups pushed over the Tuareg rebels and seized key northern cities. However, in the early 2013, Malian forces, together with French troops and soldiers from other African countries, drove them out and gained back control. Since then, Daesh terrorist groups regularly carry out raids against the army and civilians in Mali's central and northern regions. In recent years, fighting has spread across the arid Sahel region into Burkina Faso and Niger, with a deteriorating security situation in the region unleashing a major humanitarian crisis. Violence and insecurity have already pushed some 7.4 million people across three countries into acute hunger. Meanwhile, the number of internally displaced people has reached 1.6 million in 2020. That figure included more than 288,000 people in Mali, some 265,000 in Niger, and 1 million in Burkina Faso, which is now home to the world's fastest growing displacement crisis. At least 1,000 people overall have died in attacks this year, including soldiers and terrorists. The first 3 months of 2021 have seen more non-combatant deaths blamed on terrorist groups in the same period last year, the UN peacekeeping force, also known as MINUSMA, was established in Mali in 2013 and has over 13,000 peacekeepers from several countries. Over 230 peacekeepers have died in the country, and that has made Mali the UN's most dangerous peacekeeping operation.
Well, Mali is one of the key hubs for the jihadi African Muslim movement. It's all of North Africa right now. You've got Chad, Libya, Sudan, there, you know, Central African Republic, even obviously North Nigeria, and then even Northern Cameroon.
France, a former colonizer of Africa, intervened in Mali in 2013 to fight back increasing militant activity. Mali has received support in its fight against the armed groups from France's Barkhane force, which numbers 5,100 troops spread across the arid Sahel region. In addition to Mali, French force has been fighting armed groups alongside soldiers from the G5 Sahel countries, namely Mauritania, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Niger. However, the French anti-terror mission Barkhane is losing support in Mali. Hundreds of people took to the streets in the capital Bamako to protest against the presence of French troops in the Sahel region. They burned the French flag and carried banners, reading slogans such as Down with France. A recent UN probe found France guilty of killing civilians in central Mali. On January 3, French fighter jets targeted a wedding with nearly 100 guests near Bounty Village in central Mali. A UN report said that 19 civilians, as well as 4 militants, were killed. The French Defense Ministry, however, disputed the finding, saying the strike targeted an armed terrorist group. However, the UN rejected Paris's claims.
The French are heavily involved, trying to control their resources. Mali's a very rich country in gold, and it's a very valuable asset. Other than that, surprisingly, it's not that rich, but it has a significant amount of gold reserves. It's considered probably one of the richest reserves in the world.
Paris has intervened in Mali in an effort to stop terrorists advancing in the region. However, there are more important things than the lives of over 5,100 French troops. The African country's gold and uranium mines are an incentive for France's current military intervention in that region.
Shortly after taking office as South Vietnam's president in 1955, pro-American Ngo Dinh Diem began a crackdown on suspected members of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition of the North. The Cold War was in full swing, and the United States, which was concerned about a rise in communism, gradually ramped up its military presence in Vietnam. Washington finally found the excuse to justify a war in the region following an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1963, when 2 U.S. destroyers were targeted by a torpedo attack by the North Vietnamese forces. The U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. The conflict that ensued has been regarded as one of the bloodiest wars the U.S. has ever been involved in. American troops resorted to using warfares, including napalm and chemical toxins, to confront their enemy. Perhaps the most notorious was a chemical substance called Agent Orange that was used during Operation Ranch Hand to defoliate jungles to uncover Vietnamese troops and destroy crops between 1961 and 1971. The substance contained dioxin, which is one of the most toxic chemicals known to man and has been linked to severe birth defects, cancers, and mental and physical disabilities.
I mean, this is, you know, you have to understand that America has a different standard for the rest of the world than it does at home. At home, America adheres to fairly high level standards when it comes to herbicides, for example, of which Agent Orange is one. But when it comes to the poor nations of the world, such as Laos or Cambodia, a completely different standard applies.
The U.S. failure in the war and its atrocities in terms of the number of civilian deaths and the use of chemical weapons has tarnished America's image at home and abroad to date. the U.S. rained down some 600,000 gallons of herbicides on the neutral nation of Laos and roughly 19 million gallons of such chemicals in Vietnam. The chemicals were so potent that even American troops got a taste of their detrimental effects. After 14 years of legal dispute, the U.S. Congress passed the Orange Agent Act in 1991 to compensate American veterans of the Vietnam War who were exposed to the toxin. But it wasn't until the year 2000 that Washington started to admit responsibility for what the people of Vietnam and Laos have been going through. Washington kicked off a 10-year project to decontaminate swathes of Vietnamese land from the herbicide in 2019, but stopped short of awarding compensation to the families of the victims. There's also no mention of U.S. chemical attacks on neutral Laos during the war. Even after the American military acknowledged the attacks, a former American commander denied all knowledge about the use of dioxin there.
The Laos was a country that was caught in the middle of the Indo-Chinese War. The U.S. Was absolutely indiscriminate in its use of Agent Orange and other weapons of war against the population. It never apologized. It never had any second thoughts. As far as the U.S. was concerned, it was just a collateral damage. So the U.S. has never made good on that. It's never made good on the enormous damage that was done to Cambodia, or certainly the incredible bloodshed that was imposed on Vietnam.
The Vietnam War ended long ago, but not for thousands of people living in Vietnam and Laos who are still being haunted by its effects.
The annual United States Report on Global Human Rights Practices looked at human rights issues in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza as part of its global analysis on almost 200 nations. In the first such report of the Biden administration, the U.S. reaffirmed the recognition of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights and the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That is while Washington has refused to slam the Israeli regime for its illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories as well as other crimes. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outputs. That is why the UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Also, according to human rights groups, acts of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their property are a daily occurrence throughout the occupied West Bank. Additionally, Israel holds more than 7,000 Palestinians in its jails. Most of the prisoners are being held with no indictment or trial under a controversial policy known as administrative detention.
Well, in the first place, the U.S. lacks the moral authority to talk about human rights in any country outside of its own boundaries. Inside the U.S., there is systemic racism against people of color and against people of indigenous origin. And this has been going on for 400 years inside what is now the United States. Their record has been terrible. And to just a couple of days ago, the trial of the police man who killed George Floyd is taking place. So the U.S. has no moral authority whatsoever.
The Israeli regime's crimes seem to have no end, and the international community only condemns the regime's atrocities in words. This is while Israel is violating international law. The Golan Heights were part of Syria until 1967. When the Israeli regime captured most of the area during the Six-Day War. In 1973, Egypt and Syria launched a war against the Israeli regime in an effort to recapture the occupied territories. However, with Washington's help, Israel managed to retain control over the territory it occupied before. Then in 1981, Israel declared its unilaterally annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights in order to extend its own boundaries to cover the captured territories. In response, the U.S. Security Council passed Resolution 497 and condemned the annexation of Syrian territory. The Council declared the annexation a violation of international law. Meanwhile, Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. The Golan Heights territory is strategically important due to its military value. It is also a strategic asset due to its water resources and fertile land. In a relatively parched region of the world, control over the Golan's water supplies is invaluable. The Golan Heights may also have oil. Exploratory drilling suggests that the territory's reservoirs could potentially yield billions of barrels of oil. The annual United States report on global human rights practices also reaffirmed Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which the U.S. recognized in 2019. In March 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a decree recognizing Israeli sovereignty over Golan during a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington. The Syrian government denounced Washington's recognition of Israeli claims over the Golan Heights as a blatant attack on the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Over the past decades, Israel has built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Indeed, they are illegal, and nothing that the U.S. says or does can turn a crime into a legal act. Except for the USA, the entire world recognizes that the Golan Heights are part of the sovereign territory of Syria, and someday Syria will regain control of the Golan Heights.
The trial of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin began earlier this week. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old African-American George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May. Floyd's death triggered worldwide protests over brutal policing tactics and racial injustice. Prosecutors have said the former Minneapolis officer killed Floyd without regard for his life. They insist Chauvin betrayed his badge by kneeling on Floyd's neck and using excessive and unreasonable force as the black man kept begging for his life.
So you'd want to get him off out of
the high-profile trial is expected to take 1 month. During the next few weeks, prosecutors will ask medical and use of force experts, among others, to testify. If convicted of murder and manslaughter charges, the former police officer could be jailed for decades. Chauvin has denied the charges. His defense lawyers argue that the force used during the arrest was reasonable and that Floyd died of an overdose and poor health. U.S. police officers who cause a death while they're on duty are rarely charged, and only about a third of those charged are convicted. This ongoing trial is followed across the U.S. and around the world as a strong indication of how the American legal system treats deaths in police custody. The ongoing trial has captured media attention in the U.S. and around the world. Everyone wants to know how the proceedings will end. But there is still a strong possibility that justice will not be served in Floyd's case, just as it wasn't served in many other high-profile police killings of unarmed African Americans over the past years. The 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was another example in which the white officer who shot the black man was not indicted. Black Americans are disproportionately more likely to be fatally shot by police and arrested for drug abuse, and five times more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon.
Black people in the United States are incarcerated, jailed, locked up, arrested more than any other race at more than any other rate in this country, disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Even though black people in the United States represent just over 13% of the population, they're targeted and they're victimized more to the prison industrial complex more than any other group in the United States. And that's something that
we really have to begin to tackle in the United States to understand the roots of the prison industrial complex, of the police as catchers of enslaved people.
Observers largely attribute this trend to the racist roots of American policing and social structures. Law enforcement in many U.S. states, especially those in the south of the United States, have their roots in slave